Good afternoon again. Shabbat Shalom. We're in a beautiful place and with a beautiful name, Celebration. And I'm proud to announce that my wife Linda will soon be winning her ears. And she presented me with this little goofy as a souvenir of what she's achieved so far. So that's just great. But we're going to do a kind of a documentary about our trip over here and how we settled in and how a lot of the family are working for Disney. We're going to call it a mini-series. This time of year, not so good, huh? No, at least this isn't the American Idol where this guy with an accent really talks you down after you say anything. But this time of year between the Days of Unleavened Bread and the Festival of Pentecost is a special season, and we're counting the weeks to the 50th day. You know, this is their second Sabbath counting. We have seven Sabbaths and then a 50th day, which is Pentecost, or the Festival of Weeks in the Old Testament. But during this time of the year, because of very traumatic events that have occurred in the 20th century, the Jews have certain, observances that pertain to their own experience in this modern era, which I thought would be interesting. You know, so like if you had a daily Hebrew calendar, as I do, you come to the 27th day of the first month, which of course has already taken place. But about a week after Passover festival is over, they have a Holocaust Memorial Day, which of course is reflecting something that occurred just in recent history in World War II, when a third of the world's Jews were exterminated in about a 6-year period. And that day is the day that the Warsaw Ghetto uprising finally came to an end. You probably know the story of that group of people that finally were able to get together an armed resistance against the Nazis and were able to hold them for a period of time. Even though they were fighting overwhelming odds, they did have a certain degree of success against the Germans. And finally, of course, you know, the Germans had such overwhelming power that they did crush that uprising, but it ended on the 27th day of the first month, so that has become a Holocaust Memorial Day. And the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising was kind of a turning point in the whole history of the Jews in some ways. It probably led to a certain spirit of resistance that helped to bring about, just within a short time, the rise of the State of Israel. And in the calendar, again, if you had a daily Hebrew calendar, the fifth day of the second month, which is coming up this year, April 26th it will be, is the anniversary of the independence of the State of Israel in 1948. It was on the fifth day of the third month, the second month, Iyar, on the Hebrew calendar. It so happened that particular year was May 14th, 1948, but it's celebrated in Israel according to the Hebrew calendar. So that will be taking place coming up on the 26th. So I imagine this Sunday, right here in Orlando, there'll probably be some kind of commemorative events, and of course in other areas, also. You know, but these are events that are that are of interest, and they really affect the whole world. What happened in World War II eventually drew everybody in and affected the whole world, and we're still reacting to what happened in World War II. The Cold War, in effect, was a product of World War II, and on it goes. And, of course, the rise of the State of Israel has produced effects and complications that are with everybody, you know, virtually in the world now. But, you know, getting back to the biblical significance of this season for everybody, the universal significance, you could say, you know, we had the festival of Passover, and we thought about the sacrifice of Christ, the resurrection of Christ, and then we count towards Pentecost, which is the birthday of the church, you know, the beginning of the New Testament church. And Pentecost is a unique festival because we're commanded to count towards Pentecost. It's also, in a way, different in the sense that many, let's say that mainstream Christianity has, in a sense, adopted Pentecost as a Christian festival, unlike the other biblical festivals. It causes a certain complication, which I want to get into today. I'd like to go to 1 Corinthians 16. Every year at this time of year, it's good to remind ourselves why we count towards Pentecost the way we do, how we calculate when it is, because we observe it from year to year, and we're following biblical instructions when we in how to observe it, you know, how to get there, how to go from Passover to Pentecost, and there are specific instructions in the Bible on how to do it, and yet there are different spins on it. There are different interpretations of the instructions, and what we try to do particularly when this came up as an issue in the community back a generation ago, was to get all the biblical data together and get the most precise understanding we could of the instructions as to how to count for Pentecost. We settled on what was the best solution, you know, to all of the, you know, that was the way to basically understand all of the data together. We came up with that, and you know, many of us were able to understand it and do it. But then since that time, people have had sort of second thoughts and gone in one direction or another and adopted some other approach, because there are other approaches out there. So I call this talk The Precise Path to Pentecost, you know, four P's, The Precise Path to Pentecost, because there is a way to do it where all the biblical data is in place, consistent, you know, and you're following the instructions. So let's go to 1 Corinthians 16. Here Paul is writing to the church at Corinth. So this is not a Jewish congregation, though there very likely are Jews in it, but it's a predominantly Gentile congregation. It's in the Greek city of Corinth. And Paul, writing to them, is talking about his travels. And he says, "And it may be that I will remain or even spend the winter with you, that you may send me on my journey wherever I go. For I do not wish to see you now on the way, but I hope to stay a while with you, if the Lord permits. But I will tarry in Ephesus until Pentecost." So he says to them, "I'm going to stay at Ephesus until Pentecost." Well, it seems from that perspective that the church was observing Pentecost the way he refers to it in that way. Now that presents a certain complication, because in order to keep Pentecost, you have to be connected back to Passover. Because there are instructions about Pentecost that you have to count towards Pentecost, and beginning during the festival of unleavened bread, you there's a certain day that's the day that you start counting, and you count 50 days. That's what Pentecost means, 50th. So you got to, so to keep Pentecost, you have a complication as to how to count towards Pentecost. The implication is that they're also keeping Passover in the day of unleavened bread. Now if you go to 1 Corinthians 5, in fact, it would seem that they were. Okay, while we're in 1 Corinthians 5, I'm going to ask Linda to take a look at Acts 21 and find the reference to the Days of Unleavened Bread there, if she would save me some time. I decide I want to go there as well, Acts 21 or so, 20 or 21, you'll find it. In 1 Corinthians 5, in verse 6, he's talking to the church at Corinth, and this time he's being very corrective, and he says, "Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump?" This is an obvious reference to that period of time, when people are removing leaven from their homes, and they're having, if they eat bread, it's got to be unleavened during that week, and symbolically, it's living a righteous life. Leaven is serving as a symbol of sin during that period, and so you're de-leavening your homes, symbolically putting sin out, and then you have a week when you're unleavened, so you know you're living a completely righteous life for at least 7 days of unleavened bread. So your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, he says, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. So he says that they are unleavened. Now, it may very well be that they were unleavened because they were in fact keeping that season. Since you truly are unleavened, for indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness. In other words, Let's remember the spiritual meaning of being unleavened. So we don't want to keep it with leaven, nor do we want to keep it with the spiritual leaven, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So this at least implies, and some commentators I think would have to admit that at least in Corinth at that time they were keeping that festival. Now there's another way to spin it, as a person could look at this and say, well, he's referring in the spiritual sense and so on. So I can't make back a person into a corner with these verses, but there's the implication, at least, that they were keeping that festival. And as I said, it is also implied that they would be keeping it in order to be keeping Pentecost, because you need to count from that festival the 50 days in order to keep Pentecost. Have you come to the reference in Acts there?
For Pentecost?
Yeah, no, for UB.
Acts 20:16
refers to Pentecost.
Yes.
Okay, well, during that stage in Acts, you'll find a reference to keeping the days of unleavened bread as well. So keep looking. When you find it, you know, I'll just stop and go to it. It could be in the 20th or 21st chapter of Acts. Okay? Okay, let's go. Pardon? 20 verse 6. Okay, let's go to Acts 20 and verse 6. Okay. What does Rebecca want to read it? No, I mean, the tape may not pick you up. Okay, Acts 20 and verse 6. But we sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days joined them at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. So again, he's keeping time that way, in a way that would seem to assume observance of that festival. It's kind of strange to refer to it if nobody's celebrating it, because this is the book, this is Luke's writing, and Luke is not just writing to a Jewish audience here. This is the book of Acts, written in Greek. So the audience is not necessarily just a specifically Jewish audience, and yet he's still talking about, you know, doing something after the days of unleavened bread. As again, you could put another spin on it. I'm not saying you can't, because you could say, well, this is the Apostle Paul. He had his particular approach to things and so on. You know, but it does. There is at least an implication there of celebrating the days of unleavened bread. And that does lead, to, as I said, to some interesting complications. And it goes all the way back to, as I said before, there have been controversy for centuries about how to count Pentecost. And there are all kinds of ways to do it, and yet it seems that none of them really satisfy all the scriptural instructions, except, frankly, the way that we began doing it back in 1974, when we had to look into it as a community, when we had to investigate all the various options, and we came upon, you know, the way we've been doing it ever since. So let's go back to Leviticus 23. Well, first let's go back to Deuteronomy 16. As I said, it's very interesting, some of the implications of what we do or what we don't do. I gave a talk last year that I called The Passover Connection, and I showed how keeping the 14th day of the first month as a New Testament observance is such an important step, and yet it's a very radical step. Because if you're a Christian and you're keeping a Christian observance, as we do, on the 14th day of the first month, the night of Christ's arrest, if we observe what he did that night, you know, the symbols of the unleavened bread and wine, foot washing, if we have that Christian Passover, we're having a Christian observance, but we're doing it according to the Hebrew calendar, and we're directly linking Christianity with what you might call biblical Judaism. And it's something that mainstream Christianity cannot do, and will not, and does not do. You don't find that in mainstream Christianity observing the death of Christ in connection with the Hebrew calendar, except in an indirect way. And that's why I was saddened when many people whom we know who used to observe the 14th day with us have now abandoned it, and have decided that they should stop observing it, and they combine the observance of Christ's death with the night that begins the festival of unleavened bread, the 15th day of the first month. Now they have their festive meal and somehow incorporate also the funeral, the memorial service of Christ's death altogether. And as I said, in doing that, they have in effect broken a link between the New Testament and the Old by simply perpetuating Hebrew observances, you might say, according to the Hebrew calendar, but refusing to admit that you could have a New Testament observance that is yet regulated by the Hebrew calendar. I'll put Goofy away for now. Might give me some more credibility here. All right, let's go to Deuteronomy 16. What I said back then may sound a little complicated. You have to maybe mull over what I said. I don't want to lose anybody. What I'm saying is this. We have for year after year after year memorialized the death of Christ. We do it once a year on the day he was arrested, because that's the instructions that we have. The night he was betrayed, Paul tells us, is when he introduced those symbols. And he said, do this in memory of me. And as Jews do, they honor their dead on the anniversary of their death. So when Christ died, he died as the Passover lamb. He died the day the Passover lamb died. He died on the 14th day of the first month when they slaughtered the Passover lamb. So each year, on the day the Passover lamb would have been slaughtered, we come together that evening, the evening of his arrest, and we observe a memorial of his death. But we're doing a Christian observance. You know, this thing was not done in Old Testament times because Christ hadn't yet died. What was done is a lamb was killed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That was done. But what we're doing is not killing a lamb at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but what we're doing rather is having a memorial for the death of Christ on the evening that begins that day. So it's a clearly New Testament observance, and yet it's also very clearly dictated by the Hebrew calendar. So it connects the heritage of Christianity back to the Old Testament in a very direct way. And those who, in effect, refuse to do it or don't do it, or don't feel they should do it, haven't decided to do it, have in effect begun to cut loose. You know, they have begun to somewhat veer away from that concept of putting the two testaments together, treating the Bible as a whole story from Genesis to Revelation. To some degree, they've lost a bit of that. And as I said, it's a subtle point, but it's interesting, and it affects now the observance of Pentecost, as I'm going to show you. The same thing carries through now to Pentecost, as I'm going to show you. Now, if you go to Deuteronomy 16, I'll go to if the first thing it talks about here is the first month of the year, the month of Aviv or spring, which is also called now by the Jews Nisan in the Old Testament. In the earliest days, it was called Aviv or spring. Now the whole season is called Aviv, the spring. And it talks about observing the festival of unleavened bread, observing the Passover, the festival of unleavened bread. And then if you keep reading, as after it talks about that, then it goes into verse 10, Deuteronomy 16:10. It says, "Then you shall keep the feast of weeks," or Shavuot, the feast of weeks, "to the Eternal, your God, with the tribute of a freewill offering from your hand, which you shall give to the Eternal, give as the Eternal your God blesses you." And it talks about rejoicing on that festival. But how do you get to that festival? No date is given for it. No fixed date on the calendar is given. Not here, not anywhere. and so the implication would be it isn't a fixed date. And because it tells you to count there. So if you're counting there, it's not a fixed date. Now the reason I say this is because, as most of you in this room know, there is the rabbinic tradition, which most of Judaism accepts today, is to put it on a fixed date. Always on the sixth day of the third month. And yet in the biblical material, there's no fixed date for it. It tells you to count there. But anyway, in verse, if you go back to verse 9, "You shall count 7 weeks for yourself. Begin to count the 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the grain." All right, so this was, as you know, the beginning of the grain harvest, which in that part of the world is barley. So you begin the barley harvest, and you, for the first, you know, cut you take of that harvest, you begin to count towards Pentecost. Now that's very ambiguous instructions in a way. That's helpful, but obviously not enough to really be fairly precise as to how to do it. So there's more. That gives you an idea of what the agricultural cycle is involved, because there's symbolism in it that ties in with the agricultural cycle. The symbolism, as we know, is that these are first fruits. This is the beginning of the harvest. This is the action. In this particular case, this portion of barley that was cut was later that day offered up, was waved, and it symbolized the resurrected Christ. The Passover lamb that was sacrificed symbolized the crucifixion of Christ. Then during the week of unleavened bread, when the sickle, when the grain was cut, that would symbolize either the resurrection of Christ or his leaving the tomb. Then the next day, it's offered up as a wave offering, and that symbolizes the risen Christ. And maybe I'll repeat again what I did recently, if you don't mind. I'm still in from Deuteronomy 16. Let's go to John 20, because I want to show that again. I just recently read that, but I really would like to read it again. In John 20, after Christ's crucifixion, which, was, as we know, was pictured by the Passover lamb, the slaughtering of that lamb, we now see his resurrection, as I said, which is pictured by the cutting of the grain, removing it from the ground. He was removed from inside the ground. He said he would be in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights, and then, you know, now the cutting of the grain is, you know, taking it up, you know, so he's resurrected now. He's out of the tomb. But the next day, during daylight, which is what we call Sunday, is when they, you know, raised the omer, the barley, the portion of barley. So here we have, he's discovered being resurrected in John 20 by Mary Magdalene. And then in verse 35, Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" She's supposing him to be the gardener. And as I pointed out, you know, he was the second Adam. And since the first Adam was a gardener, it makes sense that she thought Christ was a gardener there. She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have hid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned and said to him, Rabboni, you know, speak, because she spoke Aramaic, which is to say, teacher, you know. And Jesus said to her, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. So this is the, at this time he said this to her, is the time they would have been, you know, offering that Omer early in the morning, on Sunday morning, first day of the week, the first unleavened Sunday, unleavened Sunday, they would offer that Omer. And so he said, I've not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God. So he is the antitype of that Omer, of that wave sheaf, you know, which is offered during the days of unleavened bread. And it is the day of the wave sheaf that is day number one towards counting towards Pentecost. As it says, you begin your count when you first take that first bit of the harvest. Then you begin counting. Now, there's more specific instructions in Leviticus 23, so that's where we'll go next. So let's go to Leviticus 23. Is everybody still on board with me? Okay, I'm trying to keep it, you know, as simple as I can. It's a subtle point, but it's a very powerful point as we get into it. Leviticus 23 and verse 15. Now remember that as Leviticus begins, 23, your first instructions are about the weekly Sabbath. So that's determined. The weekly Sabbath is given. Then the next specific day is the 14th day of the first month on which you slaughter the lamb. Then the next thing that's talked about is the festival, which begins on the 15th day and goes for a week. So now you're told on Leviticus 23:15, and you shall count for your, and by the way, I'll go back a little further. I usually do. I want to go back a little further. Verse 14. You shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. So there's an offering that you need to bring before you eat of that harvest. You know, as I said, you put your sickle to the grain, you take that grain, you offer it the next morning, and now you can start eating of that grain. And you shall, and that's important for something we're going to do later. And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath. Now the Sabbath has already been defined in here. So the day after the Sabbath, of course, is what we call Sunday. And it's from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Then you say, it says, count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Eternal. So at this point, you've gone from the barley harvest to the wheat harvest. And on the 50th day, after you've counted the 50th day, now you bring an offering which is of the wheat offering. In this verse 20, the priest shall wave them these loaves. You brought 2 loaves, if you read it. 2 loaves of baked wheat, you know, 2 loaves of bread. The priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits. The other things that he's waving, but he's waving these sacrifices with the bread you brought. The bread is the first fruits. This festival is also called by the Jews Bikurim, or first fruits, because Pentecost is the first fruits of the wheat harvest. And you took these 2 loaves of wheat and you baked them, and then you took other sacrifices, and together you offered them on Pentecost. The priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits as a wave offering before the Eternal with the 2 lambs. They shall be holy to the Eternal for the priest. And then it says, and you shall proclaim in the same day that this is a holy convocation to you. So here you have a festival, a holy day, Pentecost. And we understand that just as the wave sheaf offering pictured Christ, the risen Christ, the first fruits of the wheat harvest picture the church. The church begins on Pentecost. And so on Pentecost, the church, which is the antitype, begins, 3,000 are converted in one day. You start with 120 disciples, and they eventually become 3,000. And they are pictured by these 2 loaves, and they are risen up to indicate that, I suppose, they also, as Christ was resurrected, so are the first fruits, so can the church look forward to being resurrected. And that's done on the 50th day. So what you have is an offering during the days of unleavened bread, which is the wave sheaf, picturing Christ, and then an offering on Pentecost corresponding to it that pictures the church. So you have that connection. And you count from the first offering to the next one. You count from the wave sheaf, the day of the wave sheaf, you count until the day of the next one. Now, every once in a while, the first day of unleavened bread is on a Sunday, you know. And so you actually have a holy day, that first day of unleavened bread, which is a Sunday, and theoretically the wave sheaf would have been offered. And then the 50th day is the next holy day, Pentecost, and you have the first fruits, the wheat offering. So it corresponds very, very well. Now, most years, though, that doesn't happen. Usually the first day of unleavened bread isn't a Sunday, it's some other day of the week. However, even then, the offering is within the festival. It's not on a holy day, but it's within the festival. It's always within the festival. If you begin the season with the 14th day of the first month, the day of the slaughtering of the lamb, then you will always start counting Pentecost within the days of unleavened bread. It will be the first unleavened Sunday, so that the wave sheaf is always within the festival. And then it ties in with Pentecost. Now, what did mainstream Christianity do in order to keep Pentecost? Because Pentecost is the day that you're going to calculate. So first of all, they had to determine when they were going to observe the death and resurrection of Christ, how they were going to work that out. So the church calculated in the 4th century, made a ruling that Easter Sunday would occur on the first Sunday, on the Sunday after the first full moon of the spring. The vernal equinox occurs, and then the full moon occurs, and Sunday after that is Easter. That's going to be Easter Sunday. That's a church decision. So mainstream Christianity has adopted that day as Easter Sunday. Now, what's interesting about that is that it ties in the observance of the death and resurrection of Christ indirectly. It ties it in with the season of the year in which it occurred, because it occurred, he died on the Passover, was resurrected during the days of unleavened bread. So it ties it in indirectly, but only indirectly. In fact, it also deliberately prevents it from ever happening on the first day of unleavened bread. Easter and the first day of unleavened bread can never coexist, can never begin on the same day. Because if the first day of unleavened bread is a Sunday, Easter Sunday is next week, is the next Sunday. Because it has to be the Sunday after the first full moon of in the spring, so it can never occur on the first day of unleavened bread. There's always that distinction that is made by the calculation. So it's sort of indirectly connected, and yet it creates a split. And that is one reason why a traditional Easter food was ham. It was part of that same concept. You know, we've made this break. We're not going to do the things that they used to do. You know, so ham became a traditional food, you know, for Easter. And in the Greek Orthodox Church, they tried to have something really leavened, some very puffy bread or pastry at that time of year again to make that distinction. You know, we don't have to deal with those issues, you know. You know, now what's interesting, I found out some years ago that the Eastern Orthodox churches want to maintain a closer connection between Easter and the days of unleavened bread than the Catholic Church was willing to maintain. Because as we understand, you know, some years are intercalated. Some years there's an extra month on the Hebrew calendar, so that the holy days always occur in season, so that there's always a matching of the spring festival and the autumn festival with the actual season. So in order to do that, there are what we might call in English leap years. And so they have what we call, scholars call intercalary years, where you have an extra month added in order so that the lunar and solar cycles coincide, so that the holy days come out in season. Well, when that happens, of course, then I guess Passover and Easter would occur way out of sync. Now, the Eastern Orthodox churches during those times keeps Easter later. They actually follow the intercalation. They follow the Hebrew calendar in the sense that even though they don't keep it to exactly, you know, at the same time as the Hebrew calendar, they keep it closer, you know, and they follow the intercalation, whereas the Catholic Church doesn't. It's kind of interesting. And I called up a Greek Orthodox minister or priest, and I said, you know, I'm interested in this, you know, could you explain this to me? And frankly, it was kind of interesting what happened. I don't want to call him typical of all Greek Orthodox priests, because how would I know? But when I called him up, he got really agitated, you know, about it, you know, kind of anti-Catholic. And he said, yeah, you know, we do it this way, the Catholics do it another way. And he got kind of agitated about it. And then he wondered why I was even calling him, and he kind of got agitated about that. And, you know, please, I'm not saying he's typical of everybody every minister in that religion, but evidently it is an issue to them, you know, in Greek Orthodoxy, that they feel they're closer to maybe the original form of Christianity, that Roman Catholicism has kind of gone farther away. But actually, in effect, both of those groups to some degree have made a break with that Old Testament heritage by the way they do it. You know, it's kind of interesting. But you know what's also interesting is that the Catholic Church is connecting back to an Old Testament, let's say an Old Testament observance. Easter always is going to come out on the day that the wave sheaf was offered but only according to the Sadducee tradition, which in effect we don't follow. It's very interesting. And I want to comment on that. And I hope I'm not going to lose everybody, because it's a very interesting point. It just occurred to me, and in fact this is just today that it occurred to me, is that the way the Roman Catholic Church counts Easter, they're always going to agree with the Sadducee approach to Pentecost. But they're going to occasionally disagree with what we do. Now our community counts Pentecost always beginning with the Sunday that the wave sheaf would have been offered. And usually that is Easter Sunday. Now this year, for example, we started counting, you know, day one towards the 50th day, the same day that mainstream Christianity kept Easter. But there are some years when we're going to begin counting a week ahead of Easter. And that would also have put us a week ahead of the Sadducees in ancient times. Because it's interesting that the Roman Catholic tradition does actually connect Easter Sunday with the day of the wave sheaf. They made that link. That's the link that they made. And it explained a lot of things to me. It explained the importance, for example, even in the days of the King James translation. Does anybody have an old King James here? Nobody does. If you go back to the old King James translation, it'll explain why it seemed so important to them to follow the Sadducee approach to Scripture. How did the Sadducees differ from what I told you? What I told you was how we count Pentecost. How did the Sadducees differ from that? The Sadducees, for some reason, decided to begin counting the season from the first holy day, that is the 15th day of the first month. They don't count the season beginning with the day that Passover was slaughtered, on the 14th. They wait for the festival to begin, and then they start the season of unleavened bread. So when they read in the Bible, on the morrow after the Sabbath, you know, you should count, they decided that if the first day of unleavened bread is a Sunday, you wait till the next Sabbath, and then the next Sunday you start counting, which is outside the festival. And that's why the Pharisees couldn't agree with them. So on the years that the first day of unleavened bread is a Sunday, we start counting right then. The first day of unleavened bread is also the day that we offer the wave sheaf. I mean, theoretically, that's not necessary now, but we would count beginning on that Sunday. The Sadducees would wait a week, and then the next Sunday, you know, they would start counting the Pentecost. So they'd be a week later. And as I said, it's the Catholic Church follows that tradition, and therefore mainstream Christianity follows that tradition. So after all these thousands of years, mainstream Christianity keeps Easter on the day of the Sadducee wave sheaf. That's kind of interesting. So most years, you know, we count Pentecost beginning on the day that the mainstream Christianity, or at least Western Christianity, keeps as Easter Sunday. Whereas, as I said, there are some years that we would differ. Now, if you go to Joshua 5:10, you'll see pretty good evidence for the way we're doing it. You'll see, as I said, some pretty good evidence for the way we're doing it in Joshua 5:10. And you'll understand why the old King James had a problem with it. For some reason, the new King James decided to be, I think, more objective in the way they handled it. But in Joshua 5:10, it says, "Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month." So, okay, they killed the Passover when they're supposed to, the 14th day. And of course, that night would have begun the festival. They would have eaten the lamb that night to begin the festival. "Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight in the plain of Jericho. And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day." Now the very same day is an expression that you find in other parts of the Bible. If you go back to Exodus 12, if you go back to Genesis 17, there's a significance to that phrase. The very same day refers to the day they left Egypt, which is the first day of unleavened bread, which is the day after the Passover lamb is slaughtered. It's the day after the Passover. It's the 15th day of the first month, the day they left Egypt. And on that very day, you look back to Exodus 12 and Genesis 17, you see the significance of that phrase. It's the day that evidently that Abraham was circumcised, back in Genesis 17, and then that was the day that 430 years later they left Egypt. You know, Paul refers to 430 years in the book of Galatians. Well, anyway, if we get back to this point, how could they have done this? How could they have eaten of the produce of the land on the first day of unleavened bread? How could they have done it? Because they have to offer the wave sheaf before they do it. Well, that means that they offered the wave sheaf, they offered the omer on the first day of unleavened bread. Why did they do that? Well, because it was on a Sunday. The Passover was killed on a Sabbath, the 14th day of the first month, just as circumcisions are conducted on the Sabbath. You do not push off the Passover sacrifice if it occurs on a Sabbath. You still do it. Just as the eighth day, which is a Sabbath, is a day of circumcised, whether or not it's the Sabbath. The sacrifice of the Passover is offered on the 14th day of the first month, which is a weekly Sabbath. Then the next day, the first holy day, is when they ate the grain. And they could do it because they offered the wave sheaf. So this is a very good evidence for what we're doing. Now, the old King James was troubled by this. And so they added the word in italics, old grain, that they ate of the old grain. Now, the new King James is more objective. They dropped it out. They didn't push the point any further. What does the NIV do? Did they make an issue of old or new grain? Just interested. In Joshua 5:10, did they make an issue? We got an NIV person here. The Krugers insist on using the NIV. It's some reason. No, I'm kidding.
It doesn't say old.
It doesn't say old grain. Okay. You know, but I'm saying, but I used to wonder why the old King James was so attached to the Sadducee tradition. Now I understand why. Because mainstream Christianity uses the Sadducee tradition to base Easter. Easter is Wave Sheaf Sunday. And some Messianic Jewish types have done the same thing. They've made it into a festival they call First Fruits. Even though in Hebrew, Pentecost is called Bikurim, the Feast of the First Fruits, there are some Messianic Jews who now take Wave Sheaf Sunday and they call it the Festival of First Fruits. It's become kind of a new trend. And they're really still following that same tradition of the Sadducees. It's really interesting. In religion, there's very little that is new and innovative. The same old things just keep going and going. All right, now, there's some interesting evidence in Luke 6 that I want to get into now, and I am getting near the conclusion of this. I don't know how much time I have, but I hope I have enough time to finish this thought. There are different spins on Pentecost, on how to count it. I want to go to Luke 6. And as I said, the Sadducees had their spin. They decided that the 14th wasn't what you started with. You started with the 15th. So they used to sometimes keep the wave sheaf outside of the festival, which the Pharisees criticized them on. On the other hand, the Pharisees insisted on keeping it always on a fixed day of the month, a sixth day of the third month. They took the morrow after the Sabbath to mean the morrow after the first holy day. They decided that it always should be the 16th day of unleavened bread that you count all Pentecost from, after the first holy day. And I think most people would say that that's a bit of an extreme way of reading into the material, to say that the morrow after the Sabbath is the morrow after the first holy day. But that's the rabbinic tradition. So Pentecost is always on the sixth day of the third month. On the other hand, there's another tradition that has come down to us in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian Jews, you know, recently have been rescued, brought back to the land of Israel. Most Ethiopian Jews now are living in Israel. Probably some have also come to this country by now. A lot of Israelis wind up in America sooner or later. But anyway, the Ethiopian community, which is now in Israel, which lived in Ethiopia all those centuries, they decided the morrow after the Sabbath was the morrow after the last holy day. And so that means Pentecost for them was always on Sivan the 12th, the 12th day of the third month. It was also a fixed date, but it was after the last holy day. So you had three different traditions on how to count Pentecost. But we're actually offering a fourth one. And that one puts all the data together in the best way. And that's to begin counting on the first unleavened Sunday. And most of the time we would agree with the Sadducees, but not always. And most of the time, therefore, our Pentecost is the same as mainstream Christianity. Most years when we're keeping Pentecost, if you look in the newspaper, you'll find the Baptist churches and the other mainstream churches, Assemblies of God, whatever they are, they're keeping Pentecost the same day we are. But some years we're going to be different. And as I said, we are trying to connect back to the instructions as best we can, put all the data together, and come up with this. Now, one argument you could give against it. You could say, okay, maybe theoretically you could argue that your solution is the best solution, putting all the scriptures together. But they could argue, but then you have no evidence that anybody ever did it that way. We have historical evidence for the Sadducee tradition. We have historical evidence for the rabbinic tradition. Then we have the Ethiopian tradition. Do you have any historical evidence that anybody ever did it your way? Right? That would be what people would argue, and that would be a fair argument. And I would say, yes, in the New Testament. So, okay, let's go. So it's in Luke 6. Okay? In Luke 6, we have evidence for what we do, what we decided to do back in 1974, you know, when we looked into it as a community. We were challenged in 1974 about how to count Pentecost, and so we looked into it. And so in Luke 6, now it happened. Now some of you, now here's where the NIV, where I may have major problems with the NIV, you know, but that's okay because hopefully the NIV has notes or comments or whatever that you could look at. You know, if you were really a diligent scholar and you had a problem with the NIV, you could maybe look in the notes. I forget what they call it. Oh, look, she's got all, wow. She's come with all kinds of notes. All right. She has the NIV Talmud or something over there. Okay. Now, it happened in the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain fields And his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. Well, you know, this may not seem like anything to you, but I suppose you don't mind tearing toilet paper on the Sabbath either. There's all kinds of things that you do that are fine, normal things that the Pharisees objected to. And the Pharisees have all kinds of things that they prohibit on the Sabbath. You can't tear, you can't write, you can't erase, you can't, you know, turn on a light. You know, the rabbis were really, we had all kinds of complications on the Sabbath. And one of them was plucking some grain and rubbing it. That would just be, you didn't do that on the Sabbath. Even if you were hungry, you just had to wait and get home somehow and eat. Couldn't do that. And some of the Pharisees said to them, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" Well, because first of all, it was their tradition. But he went into some interesting theology here that I don't have time to get into today. But the point is that this happened on a Sabbath, and it was the second Sabbath after the first. So now the Greek is simply second first. The word that leads to the English suffix deutero, and the set followed by the word that leads to the Greek, the English suffix proto. You know, it's not exactly in that form, but if you look at a Greek text, there's the word deutero that leads to our English word deutero, and the word that leads to our English word proto. So it's on the second first Sabbath. And so what do you do with that? Well, this translation says second Sabbath after the first, and then others decided that they would use a different text so they could leave it out. The NIV just leaves it out because they chose a different text that didn't have it in there. You know, why look for trouble? So because not all texts have this. But the traditional Greek text does have it, and the King James sticks with the traditional Greek text, and so it's the second first Sabbath. Now, why could you have an expression like that, the second first Sabbath? Well, let's go back to that year, and let's say that in that particular year, the 14th day of the first month was a Sabbath. All right? So you killed the Passover that Sabbath. The next day was the first day of unleavened bread, and church members, Christians, would have started counting Pentecost that day. All right? Now, the next Sabbath was the 21st day of the first month. And that would have been the first Sabbath counting towards Pentecost for the church. The next Sabbath was the 28th day of the first month. That was the second Sabbath counting towards Pentecost for the church. Or whoever kept this practice. I'm not saying it was unique to the Nazarenes. You know, the Christianity originally was a sect called the Sect of the Nazarenes, because they were following Christ who came from Nazareth. That was actually a pejorative term. To call them Nazarenes, because they were trying to tell them, you're following this guy from Nazareth. It was not the most complimentary thing that a religious leader would come from Nazareth. For one thing, the Messiah should be from Bethlehem, not Nazareth. So calling them Nazarenes was not exactly a compliment, but it's what they called them. You know, and they finally started calling them Christians when they got to Antioch, in a Gentile city, that they were called followers of the Messiah, because, you know, to call them Christians, for Jews to call them Christians, is an admission that they're following the Messiah, which Jews are not going to admit. Follow what I'm saying? So Jews are going to call them Nazarenes. Even to this very day, if I'm speaking Hebrew, I call a Christian a Nozri. A Christian is a Nozri. And anyway, but the point I'm bringing out is that the sect of the Nozriim, you know, back then, it may be that there were other Jews also who weren't Christians who kept this practice. But this is historic evidence of the practice. So as I said before, the first day of unleavened bread was on a Sunday. And so they would have counted towards Pentecost beginning that Sunday. So when you get to the second to the 28th day of the first month, you've had two Sabbaths counting towards Pentecost. Everybody follow me? Okay, but the Sadducees waited, you know, because since the first day of unleavened bread was a Sunday, they didn't offer the wave sheaf then. They waited till the morrow after the Sabbath. They waited till the end of the festival, that which was a Saturday. And then the next day, Sunday, outside the festival, they offered the wave sheaf. That meant that on the 28th day of that first month, for them, it was first Sabbath counting towards Pentecost. For the church, it was the second Sabbath counting towards Pentecost. For them, it was the first. So it was the second first Sabbath. That's at least a way to understand this verse. It's not the only way to understand this verse, because obviously the King James Bible doesn't put it that way. They don't put it second/first. They put, now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first. And then you have to figure out what does that mean. And there's ways of explaining it. But it does give at least a hint of some historical evidence for this practice, that it could very well be, if to understand this verse quite literally, that there is a Sabbath that's both the second and first Sabbath. It's the second Sabbath counting towards Pentecost if you begin the way we do. It's the first if you begin the way the Sadducees do, and that is the way that mainstream Christianity has adopted, and they have connected that with you know, the date for Easter. But it does give historical data that some people were doing it the way we do it. You know, so that would represent for me at least some historical evidence, not just theoretical evidence, for the way we do it. So I think it's very fascinating that the importance of that day that we keep as a memorial for the death of Jesus Christ, the 14th day of the first month, because that also determines for us when to begin counting towards Pentecost. And so it really links what we do as Christians back to the calendar that regulated life in ancient Israel. And it makes us, in effect, sectarian. It does, you know, separate us from the mainstream. I would like to conclude by going to Matthew 7. Matthew 7, because what I call this talk was the precise path to Pentecost. And that's what I feel that it is. Taking all the biblical data into account and linking us back with the primitive church and back into the church of the Old Testament as well. And if you go back to Matthew 7, right after stating the golden rule, what we call the golden rule, and is even in spite of what you heard, it isn't he who has the gold makes the rules. It's you know, Christ says in Matthew 7, verse 12, he says, therefore, you know, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. That's Matthew 7, 12. Now, then you keep reading in 7:13. He says, enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it, because narrow is the gate, difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. So, sometimes the straight and narrow path, the challenging path, is the correct one. And I think that certainly does apply in the decision that we made a generation ago, and that we are attempting as best we can to follow the instructions of the Bible as thoroughly as we can. And in doing so, we are linking Christianity with its biblical roots in a unique way.